This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I choose this film because it was literally the first film I thought of when you asked me to think of a film, because it is sort of the germinal visual text of my childhood.
Okay.
I've watched it probably certainly more than any other film ever produced. Do you want the backstory?
Yes, please. Yes, absolutely.
Welcome to Open Form. I'm Michael Denzel Smith. 16-year-old Sarah Williams would love to spend all of her time with her own imagination. But tonight she has to babysit her baby brother Toby while her father and stepmother go out for date night. In a moment of rage, she wishes Toby away and into the hands of goblins. Now Sarah must make her way through a complex maze with mythical creatures and death traps at every turn to wrest her brother away from Jared, the king of goblins. This week's film is Labyrinth, and it was chosen by Melissa Phoebos, author of the acclaimed memoir Whip Smart and the essay collections Abandon Me and Girlhood.
So I was raised by a super Buddhist, queer, feminist, psychotherapist, and a Puerto Rican sea captain, and they were sort of like late boomers. And I was raised vegetarian and with a lot of sort of pretty unconventional structures, and we didn't really have TV. We had actually, I sort of can't believe this now, but we had a little black and white TV when I was a kid. I was born in 1980, so that was weird, super weird even then. With like a little dial that you turned, and we didn't get any stations. And so I really sort of didn't have TV and was kind of alienated from pop culture until like my adolescence. But when I was about eight or nine, my whole family went for a voyage on my dad's ship. So we, you know, crossed the Atlantic on his cargo ship. And because that's a really boring thing for little kids to do, my mom asked our neighbors, who had this like really big VHS collection, to copy us some movies randomly to bring with us on the ship. And so they copied five movies for us. And those movies were E.T., Labyrinth, The Sound of Music, which actually had to be on two VHS tapes because it's so fucking long. An anime version of Swan Lake, which anime wasn't a word. It was like a Japanimation version of Swan Lake. And maybe that's it. That's it. There were four movies on five VHS tapes. And those movies basically became like our TV for many years after that. We watched them on the voyage crossing the ocean, and then we just watched them over and over and over and over and over again. And Labyrinth was by far the most popular of those. So my brother and I would watch it like it was a TV station. Like we would just turn it on at any point. We could probably recite from any scene in the movie, like any sort of key pivotal moment. So it has insinuated its way into my consciousness, the way that, you know, biblical stories did for people who had religion growing up, which I didn't, or TV shows, right? So it's really fundamental.
So, I mean, in that you mentioned, you know, a couple of like big time classic films that people go into, but I'm curious in particular, just because of the sort of era that like Labyrinth also fits into, why Labyrinth over E.T.?
I know. I mean, this is a question I can't quite, I mean, I suspect that it was my doing because I am the older sibling by almost 4 years. So I was like sort of the boss the bossy, at least in that situation. And I think that I powerfully identified with Labyrinth more so. We loved E.T. I would say it was like Labyrinth, E.T., The Sound of Music, and Swan Lake. I actually loved Swan Lake, but it's such a sad story that it makes me feel depressed. Even if I hear the score like piping from the department store, it makes me feel sad and in my heart. But Labyrinth, I think, you know, I was sort of thinking about it a little bit as before signing on today. And being like, why was it Labyrinth? But it's obviously a story about a hyper dramatic and selfish big sister who is sort of humbled by her own character. And so I think it provided a really useful kind of allegory for me for many, many years afterward.
Yeah, I was going to say, I relate to that in terms of watching this, and I'd never seen it until you.
I'm so sorry.
No, I'm glad to have seen it. I was like, you know, one, my biggest takeaway watching it was just being like, this feels just like Jim Henson and David Bowie fever dream acid trip, like, you know, just the two of their worlds and minds combining into something that just
it really did. I mean, it's a product of its time too, right? It was like Jim Henson, like I grew up on Sesame Street, and when we encountered this movie, like I wasn't very far away from Sesame Street, but I was sort of like approaching the bend toward adolescence. And so I think I had this sort of partially nascent awareness of aspects of my personality and experience that were about to emerge. And this movie really spoke to them. Like, you know, I rewatched it for the first time in a while recently because my wife had never seen it before. Like, this makes no sense. But it's like David Bowie is such a, like, it's very queer, you know what I mean? And I think I already certainly had a sense of my own queerness. And there was I just felt enraptured by his character, who was like very gender nonconforming and alluring and sad and powerful. And there was something about that I found really irresistible. In a similar way that I think the character does too, right? And I think it was like a kind of hero's journey that featured a like gender nonconforming character, a teenage girl, and a bunch of like trolls, and a baby, and that was so. I don't know. In the 80s, it was like, there was She-Ra, and then there were Barbies, and then there were like boy stories, and all my other favorite movies were about boys. Yeah. And this movie was like the hero's journey for this like super femme girl.
Yeah, I'm reading about it and looking up sort of the influences therein, so much of it is talking about, like, you know, the fairy tales that it's drawing on, and sort of like Wizard of Oz and Snow White and all of this stuff. But what you're saying is essentially they took those stories that feel like, yes, they center like women, girl characters, but like this was a hero's journey as opposed to sort of a damsel in distress, like, I need to find, like, you know what I mean? Like, and I think that, you're absolutely right in sort of like taking that story archetype and essentially and saying, okay, well, what if we allow her the ability to go through exactly what a boy character would have in terms, but like I don't think that what it doesn't allow is sort of like those feats of physical strength. It is more imagination and her intelligence that lead her through this.
Yeah, absolutely. Like she doesn't have to, like she doesn't have to pretend to be a boy or assume any kind of drag. Like she sort of starts off as this like whimsical, self-absorbed, emotional, imaginative, intelligent girl. And that is who she remains. Yeah. Right. And of course there's like a reckoning and some messages in there about like community and reliance on fellows and she is humbled in certain ways, but she gets to remain this kind of character and also be a hero. And in that way, I do think it's a little bit radical, right?
Yeah. You're him, aren't you? You're the Goblin King. I want my brother back, please, if it's all the same.
What's said is said.
But I didn't mean it.
Oh, you didn't?
Please, where is he?
You know very well where he is.
Please bring him back. Please.
Sarah, go back to your room. Play with your toys and your costumes. Forget about the baby.
I can't.
I've brought you a gift.
What is it?
It's a crystal. Nothing more. But if you turn it this way, look into it. It'll show you your dreams.
I was saying earlier, I got into it at least because it was relatable in terms of like what takes the story into the world of the Labyrinth, and you know, her encountering all of these characters and the goblins and Jareth, the Goblin King, and whatnot. It's, you know, she is her parents father and stepmother are going out on a date night, basically. They're leaving her to babysit, and she's frustrated. She's a 16-year-old girl that does live a lot inside of her head and just sort of, like, wants to be able to do her thing. Like, her and her stepmother is, like, doesn't understand her. It, like, essentially says, you know, I would love if you had your own life. She doesn't understand what her life is at that point. But she's left with the baby, and she's like, I want you to go away. Like, I just don't want this responsibility right now. And she says the magic words that would turn little Toby into a goblin. And suddenly he's gone. And this is the fear of every firstborn is that, like, you will at some point lose your younger sibling and be held responsible for that. And I think that's like just this very easy way in for Jim Henson and crew to go into this larger world.
Yeah. I think that was definitely a foothold for me too, psychologically, because I was an older sibling and my younger brother was sort of far enough away from me that it was very much, I actually had like a very sort of caretaking, like protective relationship with him, but I did have the like, I don't know. And this sort of has followed me beyond the time when we were watching this movie, but I always had this desire to sort of protect and take care of him in ways that were impossible. And my own sort of foibles and personality and vices got in the way of that for many, many years. And so there's been this sort of ongoing parallel between our lives and the movie that I've thought back on a lot over the years. And there's also like, when I rewatched it, I was really struck by the sort of erotic undertones of it, or maybe they're not even undertones, maybe they're overtones.
Well, and I think that overtones.
There's just like this, and you know, there are sort of familiar tensions in some way. Like there's like this older, you know, masculine identified, like powerful figure who is like exerting power and alluring and kind of scary to this younger, beautiful female character. But it's also defamiliarized in a lot of ways because he's the bad guy. They never have sex. Nothing ever really happens there. And also they're in this sort of battle of the wits that she triumphs over in the end. And in some ways, I think that model was really helpful. I was not planning on talking about this, but in my 30s, I got into this like super intense, really kind of addictive, like painful relationship. And at the very end of it, I was like sort of struggling to get out of it and kind of trapped inside the narrative of the relationship. And a good friend of mine, this is embarrassing, but a good friend of mine, I had told her about my obsession with this movie, and I had recited to her the final lines of the movie when they're in that scene where the staircases are all floating and she's sort of solved the labyrinth, and Jareth is like wildly sort of gaslighting and like Hail Mary trying to manipulate her out of having sort of beaten him. And she gives this little speech that's, let me see if I can remember it. Through dangers untold and hardships unknown, I have fought my way here to the castle beyond the Goblin City to take back the child that you have stolen. For my will is as strong as yours, and my kingdom is great. You have no power over me. And it's like, you have no power over me, power over me. Which to me, I was like, oh, there is an illusory nature to power structures within relationships, right? And if you could find a way to break out of the sort of dominant perception and the person who's framing the story of the relationship, you can find agency and free yourself. And in some ways, I think that that's sort of the message of the movie, and also that you need help. Like, you need community, you need kinship, you need fellows, you need to take responsibility for other people in order to sort of access that agency. So it has come in handy for me many times over the years.
I'm one super impressed that you are able to get that whole thing.
It's deeply in there. I wasn't sure I was going to be able to do it, because I don't think I've said it out loud since like 2013 or whatever that was. But
give me the child,
Sarah. Beware. I have been generous up until now, but I can be cruel.
Generous. What have you done that's generous?
Everything. Everything that you wanted, I have done. You asked that the child be taken. I took him. You cowered before me. I was frightening. I have reordered time. I have turned the world upside down. And I have done it all for you. I am exhausted from living up to your expectations. Isn't that generous?
Through dangers untold and hardships unnumbered, I have fought my way here to the castle beyond the Goblin City. For my will is as strong as yours, and my kingdom.
But in that moment, as she's trying to remember that last line, Jareth, he's doing the sort of manipulation, and I think this is the power that you're talking about here, the power dynamic that's at play, and this level of manipulation on Jareth's part, where he's saying to her, like, I can give you everything that you want, right? But what he says is, just fear me, love me, and do as I say, and I will be your slave. And it really, like, there's something, like, interesting in that, in terms of, like, both what you were saying earlier about this character being gender nonconforming and queering of a certain type of, like, evilness that we're accustomed to seeing in sort of a male-presenting dominant form. And him not attempting to use violence in any way. He's not really attempting to use violence, right? Like, he's trying to manipulate and brainwash her in this way and say, like, look, you can have everything you want if you are willing to capitulate to me in these very specific ways that have to do with playing with both affection and fear. And I find that fascinating that he's...
It's really sort of like he's like patriarchy embodied. Yeah. He's like, as long as you come into my story and you play the role and wear this dress and go to the masquerade ball and sort of come keep me company in my kingdom in which you are subjugated, like, you don't have to suffer and you can have whatever you want as long as it corresponds to sort of my story, and I get to, if I write the script, then you get to play this empowered role, right? Like, that's the lie. It's like, if you embody femininity, if you you know, follow compulsory heterosexual scripts, mm-hmm. then you have all this power, right? Like, beauty is power, sexuality is power, like, yielding to sort of dominant power structures will enable you to triumph within them, right? Like, that's right. the story, which of course is, you know, not true.
Yeah, that's right. Like, it's the lie. That's exactly what you're saying, because what he does in that moment is position himself as subservient, is if she, decides to come along with the program, right? Like, mm-hmm. if you mm-hmm. fear me, love mm-hmm. me, I will be your slave, right? Like, he's positioning himself as if that could be possible within the context of a relationship in which she feared him.
Honestly, I have never considered this before. Now it seems completely obvious, but my first book was about how I worked as mm-hmm. a professional dominatrix for a bunch of years in my 20s. And it feels like a very similar construct, mm-hmm. right? Where it was like, my clients were these like very powerful men who were paying me, a 21-year-old drug addict, to enact these scenes in which they were my slave, but like hilarious, like as if, like the power that I was sort of exerting in those situations, like they would literally come in with scripts and be like, here you go, powerful goddess, mistress, like please enact this powerful position in total accordance with the script that I have written ahead of time for you. So yeah, it is a dynamic that I have encountered in a lot of different forms over the course of my life. So it feels validating in a way, because sometimes I'm like, it was just the movie we had when I was a kid, and so I watched it a lot, so it's in there. But actually, I do think it's coded with things that I suspect that Jim Henson and George Lucas like were not actually thinking about. They were just embedded within their own consciousness, right?
No, probably. I don't know how much radical feminist thought they were. So this is another thing. You were talking about earlier the visual script that it gives. And I was thinking about that with Jim Henson's like au revoir, really. And this, this stands out to me. This is not the Muppets. This is not Sesame Street. And I feel like, and this comes to something that happens sort of at the end there, where, Sarah is played by Jennifer Connelly, is sort of saying like, oh yes, I'm growing up, but I recognize that like my old friends have their place. Like I should still mm-hmm. embrace them. And it's this Henson sort of thing where it's like, no, there's something that we should all embrace the child like within us, you know? Mm-hmm. But none of these figures feel like they're meant for children, or like weren't meant for me as a child, I would say. Like, mm-hmm. I didn't see it as a child. I would have been completely frightened by all of these, these figures.
I had that same impression when I rewatched it recently. I think it was last year, where it felt sort of, it just felt artificial. Like the ending felt like him being like, no, this is a children's movie. I promise. But actually there are so many more powerful images that contradict it earlier on. Mm-hmm. Like one of the images from the movie that I think about a lot is when she eats the poison peach and goes into the mm-hmm. sort of reverie. Mm-hmm. And when she comes out of the reverie, she is in this like giant dump, basically.
Yeah.
And this like, I don't know, this dump figure comes like covered in trash and grotesque in the way of like all of the puppets in this movie. And she leads her into this like perfect creepy diorama of her own bedroom. And she's mm-hmm. like, here, it's your dolls and your makeup and your pretty things. And don't worry about this trash waste pile of toys out here in this like, and it felt very much like this kind of metaphor for like, no, just like hide in your childhood and your middle class mm-hmm. white femininity and girlhood, and just don't worry about the trash pile that's festering outside the door, you know, and this like very real urgent set of problems that only you can solve. Don't worry about mm-hmm. it. Just go play with your dolls. It's not, it's a very scary message. Actually not like seeking refuge in the innocence of childhood, yeah. Right? Like she's actually beset with some very real concerns and confronted with some very scary, grotesque, like physically dangerous adult confrontations.
Now stop that. Is that any way to treat someone who's trying to help you? Don't you want me to help you down?
Ludo, down.
Ludo? Is that your name?
Ludo.
Oh, you seem like such a nice beast. Well, I certainly hope you are what you seem to be.
I briefly want to talk about my favorite character, I think, is Hoggle.
Hoggle.
And I think Hoggle for me just he speaks to me in that like he really is just like, well, there's a few levels to him. He's lonely, right? And here comes someone new that he could like be friends with who needs him, because she mm-hmm. she does need him, right? Like she mm-hmm. needs him on some level to help her navigate the labyrinth, but is also resistant because he himself is subject to the whims of Jareth the Goblin King. And like, we can see that play out several times over. Mm-hmm. But I think the moment that Hoggle won me over is in Hoggle's just like, look, I'm a coward, right? Like it's after, confronting Jareth and lying to Jareth, being like, oh, I was going to show her back to the beginning of the labyrinth, and then having to go with Sarah and be like, look, I was just lying to him. Look, I'm a coward. Like, I know how powerful he is. And just that admission, the self-awareness and it's a little depressing, but it's very relatable to me. And just being like, look, I've lied in my life to people that I care about and to people that I'm afraid of, because like I'm so invested in the consequences for everyone and myself that I just like can't bring myself to the truth, you know? Like,
I know.
Like Hoggle's just trying to like be loved, but also survive his conditions. And it's like,
exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. I find him such a sympathetic character also. And in some ways it's like maybe it's also about live. I mean, it's sort of a, definitely an illustration of like life under despotism or dictatorship, yeah. Like a political structure where everyone has to be complicit or, you know, pay enormous personal costs, yeah. Right? But also, like, just in hearing you talk about him, it's like every single character in the movie is so lonely. Sarah's lonely, Hoggle's lonely, that little fox character is lonely. Bluto is incredibly lonely. You know, he's like, so he has the rocks for friends.
Right.
Like, powerful, but sad. And Jareth is also like, he has all the power. He's at the top of the hierarchy in the movie. And another image that I think about a lot when I think about this is sort of his most famous song in it when he's, you remind me of the babe with the power, but babe. When he's sort of dancing around his castle with all his disgusting little disciples. And he's just like, his whole face is sort of defined by this incurable malaise where it's like, maybe if I entrap this teenager, I won't be so alone. But like nothing can cure his loneliness because he's a narcissist with like borderline personality disorder. But it's a very lonely movie, right? Like everyone in it starts off very lonely.
Everyone's lonely. Are all the goblins children that he has captured?
That is a question. I do not know. I mean, that is a bleak landscape.
Because I thought about that. I was thinking.
I mean, they're all very small and gross and
this is
stupid.
But I was thinking in the contributing to his loneliness is basically that he only has his company, the discarded children
I mean,
turned into goblins.
Have we discovered that it's actually a horror movie? it might be.
It's kind of a horror movie. I mean, at least I would say it would have been a horror movie for me if my parents had ever come across it and sat me down in front of it as a child. I would have been completely horrified.
That's why we were so enraptured by it for our whole childhood, because we should not have been watching it. It's like a portal into much too adult themes for, like, I mean, because I was, I guess, like 8 or 9 when we started watching it, which means my brother was like 5.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is pretty young for the goblins and the Bog of Eternal Stench.
I think Jim Henson didn't think so, apparently.
No.
He wanted this from the hands of him. Melissa, what's one lasting image that sticks with you from Labyrinth?
I would say there's this sort of iconic scene in the movie early on where Jareth the Goblin King, played by David Bowie, when he first appears in her bedroom, and he has this glass sphere that he's sort of juggling, and he's doing this sleight of hand that I don't know if they use special effects or if he actually learned how to do it. I dated someone briefly who could actually do it, so they might have taught him. And he's sort of juggling this like crystal ball, basically, that turns into this owl. And it's just seared into my memory. I think because it was one of the earliest experiences I had where I saw a character in a film that I was both attracted to. And I was sort of confused. I was like, do I want to be with them, or do I want to be them? And it was that kind of blurring, you know, because he's so beautiful and like very feminine and also extremely powerful and seductive and frightening at the same time. And I was just hypnotized.
Lisa, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me. This was so fun.
Thanks for listening to Open Form, podcast from Lit Hub Radio, produced by Justin Alvarez and hosted by me, Michael Denzel Smith. Feel free to like, comment, and subscribe to Open Forum wherever you get your podcasts, and or sign up for the Lit Hub newsletter to stay up to date on our latest episode. Next week, Hitchcock.